Welcome to Ask the Coach, a series of exclusive conversations with the most successful strength coach in the world, Coach Charles Poliquin. This is Poliquin Podcast number 3, Fat Loss. Now, here is Charles in conversation with John Connor.
Hi, I'm John Connor, and today we're going to learn nutritional strategies for fat loss with world-renowned strength coach, Charles Poliquin.
How are we doing, Charles?
Good, you?
Very good, man. Okay, if someone comes to you for fat loss, what's the first thing you will do with them?
Well, first you got to know how fat they are. So the basic test we do is a 12-site body fat test, which I call the biosignature. And what it does is it does reflect where the individual stores his fat, which is also a reflection of their hormonal makeup. So, for example, if they tend to store a lot of fat on the subscapular, which is in the upper back, we can suspect poor insulin management. Then once we do the body fat test, we get an idea of how much muscle mass they have and how much body fat percentage they have. Once you know that, then you can establish goals. So that's the first test we do. Then we do a dietary recall. So we got to know basically what are the habits that do make them fat. So what sort of eating patterns? And then the best way to do it is you ask for a 3-day dietary recall, because most people, a week is far too much information for them. And most people, when it comes to fat loss, have more excuses than a pregnant nun. So what's going to happen is they're going to say, well, those were about 3 days. Well, the reason why they're fat is they're having a bad day every day. So it doesn't matter if it's 5 days, 10 days, you'll find that, you know, it always averages out. What's important when you do a dietary recall is actually to ask them what foods they ate, what sort of portions they had, and at what times did they have those foods. Because sometimes just switching the timing of the foods could do a difference in fat loss. The third test we do is what we call a comprehensive metabolic profile, which is basically a lab test where we collect blood and urine and saliva, and we look at their hormonal profiles. We look at what do they excrete. Do they have heavy metals? Do they metabolize their minerals, their amino acids properly? We'll find organic acids in there, a bunch of different things. And for example, most people can't lose weight are magnesium deficient. So you could put them on a very good dietary protocol, but if you don't have enough magnesium, you're not going to have good insulin management.
With your biosignature you take, do you have good baselines for that? A starting point, like, is different age groups have a good percentage under this is good, under over that is bad?
We do have normative data, which is different from male and female. You know, females on average tend to be between 8 to 10 percentage points fatter than males, and that's fine. You never want to expect to have females as lean as males. But for example, in athletics, I consider anybody above 8% body fat to be fat, because that much, unless they're doing actually sumo, but the point is that the percentage of body fat, as it increases intramuscular friction, which slows down speed. So basically, if you have a hockey player, for example, who's 12% body fat instead of 8, then he's skating around with a pack sack on his back of just fat, of useless weight. So I'd rather be 4%, but that's not always realistic.
Charles, what do you think is the optimal level of body fat for non-athletes?
For male non-athletes, I still believe they should be below 10%. I mean, we're genetically programmed to be lean and muscular. You will find, for example, that males that are sub 10% body fat have far better blood profiles and lower the risk of high blood pressure than males with 15% body fat. When you're talking about females, I'd rather have them in the 16 to 20% body fat range if they're not competing. Females with lower percentages of body fat tend to have dysfunctions in the reproductive systems. For example, they may have irregular periods or no periods at all. And we know, for example, that not having your period leads to osteoporosis. So there is such a thing as too low of a body fat for a non-competing individual.
Just touching on the biosignature, can you just give a brief overview of it for people who aren't familiar with it?
Well, biosignature, basically the rationale behind it is that body fat storage is receptor mediated in the body. In other words, in different areas of the body, you have receptor sites that indicate how well the hormones are working. The first two sites we measure is the chin and the cheek. They're the first two to drop off in any fat loss programs. So all the formulas who do not use chin and cheek cannot measure early drops in body fat. Next after that, you have the pec and the tricep sites, which are indicators of the levels of androgens in the human body. So they're a reflection of how male you are. Interestingly enough, this optimal ratio is between the pec and the tricep. If the pec values are too high in relation to the triceps, it indicates that the individual is actually converting the testosterone hormone into the female component, which is estrogen. Next after that, we have the subscapular, which is an indication of sugar management, basically. And recently, studies from other groups than mine have confirmed that it's actually a predictor of heart disease. The next one after that is the mid-axillary, which is a reflection of how well the thyroid is working. Then we have the upper supra-iliac, which is a direct reflection of carbohydrate intake. So you will find that the more an individual has refined carbohydrate intake, the higher that skin fold. And then we have the umbilical, which is, and then there's numerous studies to back this one up. It's an indication of cortisol output. So basically, it is the stress makes you fat site. Next in line, we have the kneecap and the medial calf, which are indicators of how well you produce IGF-1, which is the active form of the growth hormone. And then the last two sites are the quadriceps and the gluteal fold, which are indicators of estrogen metabolism. So you could have, for example, a female that has a ripped upper body, but from the belly button down, she looks like a pear. Well, usually that's a sign that she has either too much estrogens or she metabolizes them poorly, or she has the wrong ratio between estrogen 2, estrogen 4, and estrogen 16. We also know, for example, and there's plenty of papers on that, that the ratio between estrogen 2 and estrogen 16 are the best predictors of breast cancer and many other forms of cancer. One of the things we're doing right now is we're working with a urologist in Boulder, Colorado, and what we have found is that we can predict the probability of someone having prostate cancer just based on the biosignature. There's an optimal ratio that a male should have between the pec, the triceps, the quadriceps, and the gluteal fold. And it correlates very well with optimal levels of PSA, which is a prostate cancer blood indicator. And the advantage to the practitioner who's well trained in the biosignature is that, for example, a nurse could take a male patient, do the biosignature, and right away decide whether the patient should have a PSA or not based on a body fat test. And we're going to publish that paper very soon, but it, according to the urologist I work with, it's quite earth-shattering because it will save a lot of money to the patient and the medical systems because we can predict if someone is at high risk of breast cancer, just by the way they store their body fat.
Okay, you've mentioned medical tests as well. For a lot of trainers who haven't got access to these tests, is there any telltale signs they can tell by just looking at a person, how they train, or mood swings, or anything like that, to save them the expense of these medical tests?
Well, there are different types of medical questionnaires that a personal trainer can use, but a personal trainer is not a medical doctor, so he can only suspect and he should refer immediately to health practitioners. When we do the biosignature internships, we actually show these questionnaires and teach the students when someone's at high risk and when should you refer them to a specialist. There are key questions that are correlated with various ailments, and a well-designed questionnaire can predict anywhere from thyroid to adrenal to testosterone issues, just to name a few.
Is there any one test in particular? Like, I know you like to do the saliva test as a quick predictor. Is that something anyone could do?
No, it depends where you live. Most countries, only an MD or a DO or a DC, it depends where, you know, obviously on the country, can actually administer those tests. But if you are a personal trainer, I would strongly suggest that you do associate with a functional medicine practitioner, and the relationship will work both ways, because if you refer to them patients, they're more likely to refer you clients, which you could train. And having a close relationship with a functional medicine practitioner can only enhance your business, because it will enhance your results, and success breeds success. If you're known as the guy that can make someone lose fat fast and safely, your business will grow.
Can you expand on the dietary recall you get them to fill out?
Sure. The dietary recall's primary goal is to indicate to you as a practitioner how the patient eats, at what time do they eat, and what sort of foods they tend to choose. For example, some people are led to believe that a liquid diet works best, so they take in a lot of liquid meal replacement packets, and they've been told by a previous trainer, this is great. Well, in reality, it's not true. What you find is that these meal replacement packets are loaded with added vitamins and minerals, but they tend to have far too much copper. Copper, when the dose is out of range, in the upper value, tends to be a pro-oxidant. In other words, it does radical damage, free radical damage inside the body. So it actually becomes an aging factor. And what we find is when we run blood work on these people, they're actually starting to age prematurely because of the meal replacement packets. So it is a good thing to see how they eat and what do they eat, and to be familiar with brands, because some brands are better than others. And you will find, for example, if the person always reaches for something that has a stimulant effect around 3 o'clock, what that indicates is that person has a certain type of cortisol curve, which is abnormal. That means that by 3 o'clock, their cortisol levels are too low, so they need something to jack it back up, and usually they go to the local coffee shop and refuel on Java. So, you know, there's many things you can look for, and I expand that more into internships. But for example, someone may have too high of a carbohydrate intake at breakfast, and they complain of early morning fatigue. So right away, you know how to solve the problem. What you find most of the time is people actually undereat.
For fat loss.
And the worst offenders are with females, and they tend to eat far too many carbohydrates and not enough protein. And one of the first things I calculate, and I think it is the most important thing to calculate when you do a dietary recall, is actually how much protein does the person take in a day. And if you look at studies on Paleolithic type of diets, or caveman type of diets, or uncivilized, quote-unquote, type of individuals, their protein intakes are sometimes double or triple of what modern man has. But Paleolithic individuals are very lean and muscular. So it serves as not only as an evaluation tool, but also as an education tool with your patients.
Once you have all this information, what's the first step you'll take with someone?
Amazingly enough, I never work on diet first, because I find people are too stressed by the word diet. So the first thing I do with anybody who needs to lose fat is I put them on a very good source of omega-3. Why? A lot of reasons. There's actually 13 reasons why omega-3s will make you lose fat. But one of the things it does is that it turns on the lipolytic genes. I mean, they turn on the genes responsible for burning body fat. Number two is it turns off the lipogenic genes, which are the genes responsible for storing body fat. Reason number three is that omega-3s actually raise serotonin levels. Serotonin is basically your happy neurotransmitter. People are depressed and not Prozac deficient. They're omega-3 deficient. Actually, Ireland and Wales are the top two countries in the Western world for omega-3 deficiencies, but they're also the top two countries in the Western world for depression and alcoholism. And what you find is as when you give these people the omega-3s, their cravings for alcohol, sugars, and their general mood improves. So what I do with a fat loss patient is that I just put them on omega-3s and ask them to come back in 3 weeks. And typically what you see is they lose 2 to 4 pounds of body fat a week based on a body fat test during those 3 weeks. So when they come back, their level of commitment has dramatically increased because now they're saying, "Yeah, man, this guy gives good advice." And it's less stressful to the client to take omega-3s 6 times a day than to follow a dietary pattern. And I find from experience that if you give them early success on, they're more likely to follow your dietary advice because then, according to them, you're a genius because you've actually had results without asking too much commitment.
Would you add any other supplements initially?
Well, based on a biosignature, I could. Typically, I give a very well-balanced multivitamin mineral product, but the product I choose at that time is based on a biosignature. So, for example, it's a female, and she tends to store most of her body fat south of the belly button, then obviously I'll give her a multivitamin with a strong component of estrogen detoxification nutrients, such as broccoli extract or DIM. If it's a male, and for example, he has dyslipidemia, so he has low HDL, LDL, high triglycerides, I will give him a multivitamin that is slanted towards treating dyslipidemia for that case.
And when they initially come to you, you're saying in the first couple of weeks, you would introduce training as well as that to get those results 2 to 4 pounds.
Yes, training is also part of the success formula. But as far as dietary intervention, I only stick to supplements for the first 3 weeks.
So you find in the first few weeks, it's better to add things in rather than take stuff out because people might be attached to it or...
This is a very good point. Anytime you take something away, you got to give something back, okay? Someone comes to see me for fat loss. One of the first things I explain to them is that I will never put them on a diet. So that alone takes away anxiety. Their cortisol levels probably drop 50% just from that sentence alone. However, what I do stress is they're going to engage in a lifestyle from now on, a lifestyle that drives towards muscle gain and fat loss. And I never use the word diet. Diet alone as a word raises cortisol, in my opinion, for most people. So if you want to be successful in the fat loss industry, the best way to go about is to have meetings with your clients on a regular basis, every 2 to 3 weeks. And all you should need to do is every 2 to 3 weeks is teach them 2 new habits. You'll notice that, for example, January 1st comes around and you're paying your bills. You will write last year's year on your checks till about January 21st. It takes about 3 weeks before people remember that it's a new year. It's the same with anything else. It takes about 2 or 3 weeks for people to incorporate an habit into their lifestyle. So once I have done the fish oil and multivitamin habits, I work on protein intake. particularly with females. So I give them a protein target. Now, the psychology behind it is that if they have to be concerned with a protein intake, they're not concerned what you're taking away.
Okay.
So because they start eating more protein, it gives them less appetite for the other bad foods that they have in their diet. The third habit that I teach is the meat and nut breakfast habit. That's provided actually they're not allergic to nuts, but I have found one of the fastest way to lose body fat is actually to incorporate a meat and nut breakfast, because it does regulate the blood sugar and it does it elevate metabolism. But they can't just have one type of meat, one type of nut for the rest of their life. It's really important that they vary that.
What kind of meats and nuts would you recommend?
Well, as much as possible, you want to have organic meat, but in some areas of the world, that's a bit more difficult. Let's say in the Dominican Republic, there's no such thing as not organic meat. So people eat grass-fed beef all the time, and the right type of nutrients is given to the poultry and so on. So let's say a fat loss patient in the Dominican Republic is easier to manage than a fat loss patient in America. If they live in the west of the U.S., where organic meat is readily available, it's easier than, let's say, in New York. So what I prefer to use is actually wild meat, like deer, buffalo, and so on. Why? Because they're richer in omega-3s, and omega-3s will help you lose fat, but also they're richer in CLA, and CLA has been shown to be a good cortisol mitigator, but it's also helps with insulin resistance. It helps with fat loss. So the wilder the meat, the better it is. In terms of nuts, you want them to be raw and unsalted.
Unsalted.
Yes. For most people, it depends how they salt them. If they salt them with Celtic salt, it's a different story. But the it's best to use the ones that are in bulk that you buy at the health food store. And let's say the ones in the can with coated with canola oil and poor sodium chloride.
So is there any nuts you would steer clear of?
Well, peanuts are not nuts. They're legumes, so you should stay away from peanuts. Also, peanuts tend to always have a type of fungus on them, which creates food allergies. And also, peanuts have been shown to have estrogenic properties, so unless you want larger nipples, I would stay away from peanuts.
It's not a bad thing. With regards to organic meat versus commercial meat, if a client's goal is fat loss, will the organic have a big impact on it?
Definitely, for sure. Based on my experience, as soon as people switch to organic meat, they experience much faster rates of fat loss than if they stick to just regular supermarket meat. The advantage in the U.S. is that the standards for what we call organic meats are getting more and more stringent. And it's actually getting easier and easier to get those. But I do travel quite a bit. So what I prefer to do is when I'm at home in the U.S., I only eat wild meat. So wapiti, deer, elk, things like that. Because if I come, let's say, to a country like Ireland, the odds that I find wapiti are also very low. So I will stick to beef. And if I can find it, actually grass-fed beef. But, you know, you should control what you can control and do your very best.
So the extra money spent on organic is money well spent?
Yes, because also you got to realize that they have less likely to have hormones, antibiotics, pesticides, and so on.
And
so
these will slow down fat loss eventually.
Correct. And without a doubt, you know, I started to do incorporate organic meat eating in my clients since 1997 was the first time I started to do that, and I have found from experience that the clients I do follow more of an organic meat based type of diet tend to lose fat faster, gain muscle faster. But there's a host of other blood parameters that improve, particularly blood lipids.
For someone who, I don't know, hasn't got access to organic meat, just by switching from to meat, will that help as well?
Yes, yes. Some people will say you need to eat according to your blood type. I find the evidence shows that people react to disease a different way based on their blood type, but I'm not utterly convinced that it has that much of an effect. The more important thing, to make it simple for our listeners, is that the closer you can eat to what a caveman ate like, the easier it is to lose weight. So what I tell people is, when you're going to eat something, ask yourself the caveman question, which is essentially, would you have had access to that food as a caveman? So for example, a person goes to get breakfast and they get offered bagels. Would a caveman have bagels? No, so don't eat bagels. Would a caveman could have access to eggs and steak? Sure, so he could have that. Because we have to distinguish between carbohydrates and neocarbs. Neocarbs are man-made carbs that were there after the caveman era. So for example, berries are carbs, they're good carbs, and a caveman had access to them. Donuts are neocarbs, so a caveman did not have access to donuts, so you should stay away from it. It's very simple, but it works. You don't need to go into large philosophical debate for what to eat. I mean, basically, if a caveman could eat it, so essentially, I like a high-protein diet, but not necessarily a low-carb diet in the sense that Dr. Atkins designed. Only because, for example, cheeses tend to have a lot of oxidized cholesterol, and that's a bad type of cholesterol that raises your blood cholesterol levels. But for example, organic meat does have cholesterol, but that cholesterol does not raise your own cholesterol. So it's oxidized cholesterol. For example, powdered eggs that you'll find in most major hotels' buffets will raise your cholesterol dramatically, particularly the bad type. If you eat free-range eggs, you could have 12 a day, and actually your good type of cholesterol will go up and your bad type will go down. So there's a difference in the choice of foods you select.
Okay, you've talked about breakfast there. What would be the next meal? Would you concentrate on just 3 meals a day?
No. Most people lose body fat faster if they take in between 5 to 7 meals a day. So let's say a female could have salmon and cantaloupe for breakfast, okay? And then at lunch, she may have a chicken breast and a spinach salad. And then mid-afternoon, she may have some nuts and a pear. And then dinner, she may have cod, steamed vegetables, and shrimp cocktail, for example. And that will maximize her fat loss. But basically, I like most clients to eat every 2.5 to 3 hours, as long as they're caveman foods.
Can they repeat the food they're eating? Can they have the same foods for breakfast as a snack?
Yes, but I would suggest that people vary their foods as much as possible. There's quite a few studies that have shown that the average human rotates through only 17 foods for most of their lives. You know, they made it odd. Yeah, at an odd time, some kiwi or some guava. But 99% of the time, their diet is based around 17 foods. The problem with that is that they're not exposed to a variety of nutrients, which we probably don't even know exist yet. I mean, more and more we are discovering essential nutrients that are not necessarily vitamins or amino acids, but phytonutrients that, for example, coffee, if you listen to a lot of people, is evil. But now we know that coffee actually extends life. Coffee drinkers tend to live 5 years older and people don't drink coffee. Why? Because actually coffee for most people is the only source of antioxidants they get. There's actually quite a good antioxidants in coffee. Also, coffee contains what we call coffee polyphenols, which actually help the individual improve their insulin sensitivity. So they actually prevents long-term the onset of diabetes. So coffee is not necessarily evil. The problem with coffee is that if there are two foods that one should eat organically, it's coffee and butter, because they're the ones that are most likely to have pesticides. So organic butter and organic coffee are very important choices.
You say to rotate their foods. How soon can you go back to a food? So if you have chicken on Monday, how soon can you go back to chicken?
What I have found, I used to run with clients a lot of food allergy panels. Reader's Digest version of that is that we found that if clients ate the same foods over and over again, even though they were healthy foods, they tend to become sensitive to them. But we also found that if you change your foods over a five-day rotation, so let's say for breakfast Monday you have chicken, Tuesday you have turkey, Wednesday you have buffalo, Thursday you have ostrich, Friday you have beef, and then you keep rotating, you'll find that these people do not develop food allergies. They actually go away.
You've also mentioned cheese is a high source of bad cholesterol. Is there certain cheeses that are a source of that are okay?
The more the cheese is aged, the worse it is for you. I'm not big on cheese. I know Atkins is big on it because
it's easy to eat.
Easy to eat, but it's also low carb. But the caveman didn't have access to cheese. So again, I'd rather, same thing with milk. I mean, I can't see a caveman running around after a Norrock, you know, to go get the milk. So, you know, or a yak or whatever it is. So, milk is actually quite recent quite recently introduced. I'll repeat that. Milk is recently introduced, you know, if you look in relative terms to the human diet. There are blood types, though, that have adapted better to milk, but you got to consider that the milk was raw, not homogenized. Homogenized milk contains an enzyme called xanthine oxidase, and that has been shown to increase LDL. So if people use certified raw milk and they're tolerant to it, I don't have a problem with that.
But that's very few people.
Very few people. And the odds that you find certified raw milk in most countries is actually lower than to find Shakespeare's works in Britney Spears' library. So, you know, certified raw milk is good if you can tolerate it.
You've mentioned that you were talking about a diet for a person there, and you included quite a lot of fruit. Another thing is people say you should cut out fruit initially on a fat loss program.
One of the most common things you see to successful fat loss programs are what we call the boot camp approach. In other words, you go strict for a certain period of time, whether it's Johnny Bowden or Mauro Di Pasquale, which are colleagues of mine who I respect greatly, they tend to use a boot camp approach. So do I. I think the boot camp approach should not be longer than 14 days for a variety of reasons. During that period, people should only get their carbs from veggies. Once that 14-day initiation period is over, people should reintroduce fruit, but the first fruits they should reintroduce are low glycemic. Your best bet would be berries and apples. Any fruit with a thin skin tends to be richer in antioxidants because it has a thick skin. The body's got to protect itself from the harmful effect of sun rays. So it does make its own supply of antioxidants. So for example, an apple is far better than a cantaloupe as a fruit that you reintroduce in a diet. I would stay away from dried fruit and bananas, which tend to have a higher insulin load. And of course, bananas have a thick skin, so bananas are fairly low in antioxidants.
Would the person's body fat percentage have any influence on when they can introduce fat? If they're still way too fat, would you still keep them on no fruit, or you'd still introduce the fruit?
No, I would still reintroduce the fruit, okay? Because I think once they've passed a 14-day initiation period, if they keep the carbohydrates too low, they actually become poor oxidizers of branched-chain amino acids, so it impacts how much energy they have in training and so on. So I would prefer that they eat fruit, but they have to choose the right type of fruit.
Charles, what would you say to those people who say a high-protein diet is bad, especially to the kidneys?
Well, I would say that they're completely wrong, because if you look at the research, there are no papers that indicate that a high protein diet is harmful to the kidneys. There's actually a website where there is a contest, and in order to win the prize money, you have to come up with those studies that show that high protein diet is harmful to the kidneys. And the contest has been on since 1994, and no one's ever claimed a prize because those studies do not exist. However, if you do have a existing kidney pathology, a high protein diet could worsen it. But for a healthy individual with no kidney ailments, there is no scientific evidence whatsoever that shows that a high protein diet will be harmful to the kidneys.
Also, another thing we haven't touched on is calories. A lot of people say calories is key. We've talked about foods at the moment, combination of foods, what to eat, when to eat it. Do you pay much attention to calorie intake?
I never do, because I think patients should know the difference between a vacuum and a mouth. So people should learn to regulate their appetites. But if you do provide them with the right nutrients in the right proportions, they learn to self-adjust their appetite. And one of the reasons why people tend to gorge is because they're deficient in omega-3s, and we take care of that the first week anyway. The other thing is that a calorie is not a calorie. People, you know, I've said,
a calorie is a calorie is a calorie.
Yes, but actually in research, that has not been found to be true. Because, for example, if you ingest 100 calories from protein, it takes about 30 calories to metabolize that. But if you ingest 100 calories of carbohydrates, it only takes 5 calories to metabolize those.
Is that regardless of what type of carbohydrates it is?
No, not necessarily, because let's say if you have carbohydrates from legumes, they tend to be digested differently than if you're having them from spaghetti. There are differences. But needless to say, as a rule of thumb, protein is more thermogenic than carbohydrates are.
When you've changed people's diet, you've also said in the past you've introduced a cheat meal. Can you give guidelines on that cheat meal?
Well, basically with a cheat meal, you will have people lose weight faster if you allow them to cheat about every 5 days. People who are strict all the time do not lose weight as fast as people do cheat every 5 days. But there's a science to the cheat meal. First point is that whatever they want to cheat on should be put on the table. Not in front of the TV, just where you eat. You should also eat all the protein you're supposed to eat at that meal first. Then you eat your cheat foods. The rule is, as soon as your butt leaves the chair, the cheat meal ends. So it's not a cheat evening, it's not a cheat 36 hours, it's a cheat meal. That's the distinction. What you find is that people who use a cheat meal tend to raise their metabolism after, and they tend to be better oxidizers of branched-chain amino acids once they've had a cheat meal. And psychologically, the fat loss process is far easier to handle if they have something to look up every fifth day. And a cheat meal should be around 6 o'clock, not before going to bed.
Is anything allowed at their cheat meal?
Initially, I tell them they can eat anything they want. The reason why I tell them to eat anything they want is that they discover very quickly what they're sensitive to. So, for example, someone, you know, will tell me, you know what, right after my steak, I'm having 2 liters of milk and 16 Oreo cookies. I'll say, sure, go ahead. Then they wake up the next day and their face looks like a Swiss ball. Their joints hurt. Their tongue hurts. Their eyes are stingy. And then they realize they're allergic to milk and wheat. So the next time they brag about their upcoming cheat meal, they'll ask me, what do I suggest? I tend not to be too directive towards a cheat meal. I let people choose whatever they want, and then they quickly eliminate the bad ones. And only once they ask for suggestions that I do tell them what they could eat. For example, there are better cheating choices. For example, chocolate-covered almonds are a better cheating choice than what people call jelly beans or jelly babies, depending on the country. But if they do follow all the rules for the cheat meal, they should be fine and keep losing weight. I've had a client who managed 5 fitness gyms, and he's clinically obese. and he lost 150 pounds over 18 months using a 4 days on, 1 day off approach. And for him, he was from Israeli extraction, and he had three typical Israeli desserts. Every night he cheated. So he had some honey-covered type of pastry every time. And it didn't forbid him from losing all that weight. So I think that it is crucial that people who are in a fat loss program have a cheat meal. Actually, I found that people are what I call dietary Nazis, who tell their clients, you can't cheat, you always have to be on, da 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 da. They don't have any success after 12 weeks because usually the patient quits. But if they do have a cheat meal every fifth day, they're more likely to stick. For some people, the practical approach may be a cheat meal a week. So they may say,
save it for the weekend at a social event of some sort.
Yeah, for example, you know, I have a birthday coming up. My kid's gonna be 5 years old. We're gonna have birthday cake on Saturday. My cheat meal is supposed to be Friday. So I tell him, well, I'll have your cheat meal Saturday and have as much cake as you want. So that's when you do make some subtle changes. I think the cheat day should be between every 1 to 5 to 1 to 7, you know, and then you will find differences amongst individuals. But 1 out of 5 works for at least 70% of cases.
You said to always eat your protein before the cheat meal. Would you always recommend eating protein first in a meal?
Always, because it is digested far better.
Okay. If you have someone coming to you and they're following all the guidelines we've gone through so far and they're still not losing body fat, what would you do from there?
First thing I would do is verify if they actually understand what I've said. Because perception and reality are two different things. For example, I was working with a boxer who was preparing for the World Championships, and he was on a caveman diet. And he was training really hard. We were supervising all the training, and he wasn't really losing fat. So I was like, there's something not working here. So I said, let's go to lunch. We go for lunch. He orders the perfect meal. He had scallops and a salad. And when the waitress asked, do you want anything to drink? He goes, yes, I'll have a lemonade. And I looked at him and said, how many lemonades a day do you have? He had 10. Well, lemonades is just loaded with sugar. But in his mind, liquids didn't count. So it's kind of funny to think that, you know, you should know better, but actually, he didn't think there was anything wrong. So once I explained to him, hey, you can only have water, coffee, or tea, then he started losing body fat. So you do have to verify. For example, juice, a lot of people think juice is healthy. Juice is junk food for most people. So you could have juice post-workout because you're more insulin sensitive. But you'll find, for example, fructose, the average couch potato can only handle effectively 5 grams of fructose a day. That's why. But normal servings of fruit won't
create a problem. How much is 5 grams?
It's 6 grams minus one. Like, no, 2 grams of 5 grams of fructose would probably be the content of an apple and a peach, for example.
That's it for the day.
Yes. Well, athletes can handle as much as 30 grams of fructose a day without any
adverse reactions
in their blood profiles. Also, the other thing that you should look for is you ask the medical doctor that works for you to check for glycosylated hemoglobin. That's basically a blood marker that will tell you if the patient is lying or not. It is impossible to follow a caveman diet and have a rise in that blood marker because it's basically a blood marker that will tell you how much insulin that person is making every day. And if it is high, they're cheating on their diet. And a lot of people lie about their diet. So, you know, I use that test every time. If they're elevated, if their glycosylated hemoglobin is normal, then you have to look at either heavy metals, internal pollutants, or hormonal dysfunctions. For example, if a male has 110 of testosterone, I'm talking about American units here, I mean, he cries watching Bounty commercials, so obviously his testosterone is too low. he's the type of guy that will ask you if his pants make him look fat. So when you do have low testosterone, it's very hard to burn fat and build muscle.
Is that same for a female?
It's true for a female. If their androgens are too low, obviously you don't want the same quantities of testosterone as a male unless she wants to start shaving her back every week. But the point is that androgens are usually the culprit. I would also run a thyroid panel and then see if that's out of line. And there are nutrients that can restore thyroid health. If another thing we look for, and it is usually the cause for people not losing fat, it's actually heavy metal content in the body, especially mercury levels. So for example, if your fat loss patient used to consume a lot of tuna before they became your patient, you can be sure that their mercury levels are very high. Anything above 3 in the mercury levels is bad. I've seen people who can't lose weight and their mercury's are in the 80s. You know, so basically, you could use them to measure temperature. So what happens with these people is that you need to put them on a mercury detoxification profile, which a detoxification specialist can help you with. I would use a functional medicine practitioner in that case. There are a lot of myths, though, about mercury detoxification. For example, one of them is people say, well, you can lose chlorella. It's a really good mercury detoxifier. It's not a mercury detoxifier. It's a mercury mover. So it moves it around the body, but usually moves it to the brain. I'd rather have mercury in my bones than in my brain. Okay, so mercury as... There are a lot of great ways to remove mercury, but it's got to be done under a qualified medical person.
We haven't really touched on training. What kind of training protocols would you recommend for fat loss?
I have found actually the best one to lose body fat is what I call the German Body Comp Program, which I've written an entire book on. I'm in the process of writing a book with Dr. Mark Houston, who's probably one of the world's best cardiologists. And the book will be called The Functional Medicine Approach to Fat Loss. And we cover basically everything you need to know about fat loss, especially resistance training programs and energy system programs.
I think the only thing we haven't talked about is a post-workout shake for someone who would have high body fat.
It is important for them to have a post-workout feeding. It should be something that leaves the stomach very quickly and is anti-catabolic. Actually, in a research recently, in the last 6 months, people are debating whether to use whey protein or casein. The jury is not out yet, but for sure, the person should have a protein shake, which should represent about 1 gram of protein for every 5 pounds of body weight, minimum. And you should add glutamine because glutamine tends to resynthesize glycogen without elevating insulin levels. And it should also have glycine. Now, the amount of glycine, the target should be 20 grams, but most people have livers that are quite toxic. So I tell them to start at 2 grams and increase per 1 gram per dose as they go along until they tap out at 20 grams. And that has been shown actually to lower cortisol levels faster post-exercise.
With some people, they say the preparation for a lot of these dietary protocols is too hard, like, you know, bringing food with them to work or, you know, cooking meat for breakfast instead of having a quick cereal or actually having no breakfast. What advice would you give to those people?
Stop pissing and moaning because you're going to be fat all your life. I mean, you know, people have to take responsibility for their fat loss efforts, and it's not that much more work. I mean,
you
have to eat anyway. So I would say, you know, you could cook the meat, and in the morning you don't necessarily have to eat it at home. I mean, I know a lot of my clients will, let's say, make up buffalo patties and let's say a bowl of cashews, and on their way to work they got a bowl with a fork, and they pre-cut the buffalo pieces and they're chewing them as they're riding to work. I mean, women put makeup on as they drive, so it's not that hard to eat as you drive. It's like walking and chewing gum at the same time. It's not that complicated. So that's a way to save time. But I just tell people it's excuses. What is the total preparation time of cooking two buffalo patties and pouring cashews in a bowl? You know, we're looking at about 4 to 6 minutes. That's it. So how long does it take to make a bowl of cereal? Maybe a few seconds, but if you keep eating cereal, you'll be fat. You'll be fat, that's all.
Charles, would you have any more references that people could refer to for fat loss and training information?
Well, I got two other books called Ask Coach Poliquin, Volume 1 and 2, which do have a lot of questions most people have about fat being answered. And obviously my website, www.charlespoliquin.com, where we have countless words on fat loss questions, ranging from what's the impact of soy on weight gain to detoxification processes.
Okay, Charles, that's some great information. Thanks very much.
More than welcome.
So that's it for this Poliquin podcast. Ask the Coach with Coach Charles Poliquin is an exclusive series of conversations. It is for the sole purpose of its audience. Any rebroadcast or reproduction of this is strictly prohibited. It is for entertainment purposes only, and it is not a substitute for professional medical or health advice, examination, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health professional before starting any new treatment, making any changes to existing treatments, or altering in any way your current exercise or diet regime. Thank you for joining us on Ask the Coach. Until next time, be healthy, lean, and strong.